everybody. My name is Doretha Gibson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I've never felt more grateful in my life to be alive, to be sober. I've never been in a room full of so many friends of mine that I've known for so many years to be consistent friends in my life. This is my home group meeting where sobriety began for me. Not where I first started attending AA, but where my sobriety began. I want to welcome you newcomers, the ones who raised your hands, the ones who didn't. And I don't know about you, but I was a newcomer for a year in my mind, and I think in the minds of some of the people around me. So if you fall into that category at all, I'd just like to say this, that if you are new and if you're in that bunch in the first week particularly, and if you feel that this is a nice place but it's probably not going to help your particular problems, and if you feel that you're probably not an alcoholic, but even if you are, this can't be the answer to your problems because they're a lot more complex than that. They're a lot more complex than just to say whether you get drunk or not. And if you feel that your case is different and unique and that we're nice people but this isn't going to work, then welcome, because that's exactly how I felt. I attended AA for quite a while, and I attended these meetings after I got sober for a while before I became an alcoholic in my mind. And you know, I'm going to put my watch up here just so I'll know what time it is. Okay, this last year, one of the things I was able to do is put aside some time in my schedule to be able to answer the phones at central office, and they were nice enough to let me do that. I did it for about 10 months, and got a lot of 12-step calls there. That is, people who'd never been to an AA meeting and who didn't really know what it was about. And for one reason or another, they called central office. And this one lady called me, and she changed the course of my year for me. And she asked me a normal question, you'd think, for somebody who's calling central office. After talking to me for a minute or two, she said, "Well, what I'd like to know from you, she said, is why do you think you're an alcoholic? And you tell me you've been sober for 9 years or something, and why do you still go to meetings?" And I'd like to say this to you about that. That's the whole purpose of all the AA talks I've ever heard. It's the whole purpose of the big book. And it's kind of like asking a philosopher to give you the meaning of truth in 30 seconds. I answered her question. I don't know what I said. I just know that when I'm doing an AA job and I'm just show up to do it, the words come when the words are needed, and that's good. But it made me go back to the book. I try to look at the book regularly anyway. I'd read it probably through in my once-over lightly fashion maybe 3 times. But this time, I've dabbled at it, and then I've seriously been reading it, and every time I look at that darn book, I see something new that I haven't seen or recognized before. And I came here with a lot of education, and I'd read a lot of books. And when I read that book, I thought I had read that book. And I'm telling you that now in my 10th year of sobriety, in looking at it, every time I pick it up, I see something new that to me is important. One of the things that I have noticed this year is that, and I don't know if it would have helped me to hear this when I was just brand new in sobriety, but I like to think about it now. There are 4 things about being an alcoholic that don't apply to normal drinkers. And I'm the one who's lumped it into 4, but I believe you'll find that they are in the book. One is the craving and obsession for alcohol. I certainly had a craving and obsession for alcohol that progressed through my 23 years of drinking alcohol. At the end, I was either drinking or thinking about drinking every conscious minute of my life. Second, there's what is called, and this is by Dr. Silkworth in the preface there, that special effect. It says later in the book that most alcoholics drink for that effect. Both speakers talked about it tonight. Dr. Silkworth refers to it as that sense of comfort and ease that an alcoholic gets from a few drinks. I think sometimes it came, like Dan said, just from looking at the bottle on its way to your glass. Sense of Comfort and Ease says it pretty well for me. I've heard it called that alcohol changes one's perception of reality, just instant changes your reality. I've heard it called instant omnipotence. I think this, of all the things that make me an alcoholic, is the most seductive, and this is the killer. Because the longer I lived, the worse my emotions got, the worse my life got, the worse my mistakes piled up one on top of another, the more I needed to change the way I felt on a regular basis. And that was the second thing. The third thing that I see in the book, and one more thing I'd like to say about that is I didn't know that everybody didn't get that feeling. I had no idea, and I didn't realize that until well after I'd been here for a while. And then the third thing it talks about, as I see it, the third thing is the inability to control and enjoy my drinking. And that was a progressive thing, too, over my 23 years, and that normal drinkers don't have that. And I didn't know normal drinkers didn't have any of this. When I got here, I just thought everybody drank like I did, and I drank like everybody else did. If you drank and I drank, then everything else was the same. But it says no. That's for alcoholics, not for normal drinkers to have those problems. And then the last, and I think you got to have the first three before you can have the last. And this is not for normal drinkers. This is for the special drinkers, the alcoholics. And that is that sobriety becomes untenable. Sobriety becomes untenable, and I think that's what we usually refer to as a bottom. For me, sobriety was untenable. Mary talked about feeling that she wanted to die. By the time I got here, and just the time I got here, I hated being alive. I really hated being alive. Alcohol was made it just bearable to be alive. So, I don't know if I'd heard that in the beginning when I was first new, if I would have meant anything. I said it means something to me now, and I know I'm an alcoholic. But I only learned those four things to put them in a row like that this year. I learned I was an alcoholic just by showing up and doing these actions here. And the funny thing about that is that I haven't learned anything here in my heart, something that I can take and live with and understand and feel and affect my life with by words. It's been by my actions, everything. Finding the higher power, finding how to live these steps, finding how to do these steps has been by taking the actions later and then understanding it was a step later, except for the fourth and fifth. That's something you sit down and you do it, and I was told how to do it anyway. But except for that, all the rest of it has been just by doing it first and then realizing later that you're doing it. Kind of like I've heard it equated to riding a bicycle, and that's the best I can say. I couldn't learn how to ride it until I just got on it and tried and fell down and tried and fell down and tried and fell down, and then finally I'm riding it, and then better and better as time goes on, and that's how I see it. Well, I'm going to tell you now what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Because I wasn't born an alcoholic, I mean, I didn't drink until I was 21. I don't know if I was an alcoholic or not, but I didn't give it a chance until I was 21. There's just a couple of things about before I was 21, and Mary was talking about her childhood, a couple of feelings that had developed. For one thing, when I was 9 years old, I had a feeling when I was behind a church doing my nine-year-old thinking or whatever I was doing, I got the idea that I understood God's whole truth. I mean, all of it. Okay? It was just put upon me. And I realize now, after I've been sober a while, that was an intellectual, not a spiritual experience. I certainly thought it was a spiritual one then, but the reason my clue is that it's an intellectual experience is that I had never in my life prayed, ever, until I was in AA, until I had done what I did to try to reach that third step. Never. And the reason I didn't was very simple, because I knew everything God knew, and God knew everything I knew. God knew I knew everything He knew, so there was nothing to talk about. He didn't ask me any questions, and I didn't ask Him any questions. And I was put ahead in school, and I was a fast learner, and I got the idea that my mind told me that my mind was probably the eighth wonder of the world, and I agreed. It seemed like a reasonable proposition to me. And my mom and dad divorced and married each other three times by the time I was 15, so we had a lot of drama and stuff. But that's enough about the childhood thing. Now let's just zip right on up until I'm drinking at 21. I figured when I took that drink, if I drank like my dad, I'd know as an alcoholic, and if I didn't, I wasn't. End of question. So, they gave me a champagne party for my 21st birthday, and I didn't, as far as I know, I didn't do anything terrible things. I just thought I was pretty sophisticated, and I was just doing my grown-up thing and drinking like a grown-up, and that was that, and I was not an alcoholic. And I progressed. I was not a social drinker. I think I was an alcoholic, but I didn't drink every day. I think I drank every week. I probably drank more than once a week, and I occasionally got in trouble, occasionally overdrank. There was one other thing. The reason I didn't do that is because after I had that God thing, that I was going to tell the world for God how, you know, His truth, at some point He was going to come down and tell me to do that, and we were going to tell you. But I also, behind that, felt very responsible. So I promised myself not to drink, not to smoke, not to get improperly mixed up with boys until I was 21 or married, whichever came first. Well, I married at 20 to a Mormon, so I didn't have to do any of those things yet. And after 6 months of marriage, I was 3 months pregnant and left that marriage. So on my 21st birthday, I had those drinks, and 2 years later, I married again, and that was as a result of getting drunk. My sister was going to run away and get married, and my mom and dad wanted me to go and protect her. And I don't know about the rest of them, but I got drunk that night, and I ended up getting a little bit pregnant. And I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell the young man who was involved in that problem. And I refused to see him any after that. I caused that pregnancy to be terminated by my own crude methods. And I thought I might die, and I thought I deserved to die, and I'd only been drinking 2 years. And I didn't blame alcohol for that. I never blamed alcohol for anything. It was one of the things that made me feel worse than my life and anything I ever did, and that's why I mention it. For years, I would see I thought it was a little boy I was supposed to have. That first marriage, I had a little girl, and I thought this was supposed to be my son. And I would look around from time to time and see little boys at various stages of my life and say, yes, that's how old he would be, that's what he would look like, or that's what he would be doing now. And yet, by the time I got sober, 23 after years later, and I was working on my fourth step in here, and I was praying to be honest and thorough, I remembered that. Abortion. A long time ago, I had smothered that along with so many other memories and feelings of painful things that I had done or not done and felt guilty and remorseful and bad and that I had actually blocked that out, and it came back in my mind, and I thought, oh no, why do I have to remember this? Now I'll have to tell it. But you know what I realized during my progressive drinking? I ended up getting married 6 times and divorced 6 times. By the time I got here. And as I see it, as I went along making all these bad judgment calls, marrying the wrong people, leaving them after 1 week, leaving after 2 weeks, leaving after 6 months, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm sorry, let me get the handle on this here. What I'm trying to say is that year after year, I built up remorse, guilt, inadequacies, insecurities, bad feelings that got pasted onto my heart and soul and never came off. As long as I drank out there and went through my alcoholism prior to getting to AA, all of the bad feelings and the guilt and the remorse never got cleared away. It was just like a snowball. And when I got here, I was just this great big snowball of pain. And I didn't know you called that pain. I just knew I was depressed and wanted to die. I think, you know, there's the loneliness. I felt that I was more sensitive, and I've heard it talked about here. I felt terribly different from everybody else, and I didn't know that was alienation and isolation. I just thought I was different. That was my cross to bear. And I did know... By the time I married that fourth husband, we stayed married 10 years. That's where I did have the son. I married him in order to have the son. And I did. And we also did a lot of traveling. And I always had this feeling that whatever I was doing in life was not quite it. And there was something I'm supposed to be doing that's it. And what in the world was it? If I could find it, I'd feel all right, and then things would be all right. Another misconception I had and lived by until I got well into AA was that if I could just, whatever it was that's wrong with me or bothering me, if I could think it right, then my actions would follow, and I mean, then my feelings would follow. If I could think it right, I would change the way I'd feel, and then it would change the way I would act last. And I'm telling you that that never did work. That got me here, along with my best judgment, that got me here. And I have found out in AA that what does work for me, what has worked here and changed my life in every best way that can be, is by simply doing the actions, and then next the feeling follows. Slowly, 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 the feelings tag along, and then last but not least, like the tail being wagged by the dog, comes the thinking. And it actually changes my thinking. I change my actions, and then come the feelings, and then comes the thinking. And it's just incredible. Anyway, my drinking, as I said, progressed. I'd like to tell you something about husband. Let's see. I finally got away from husband number 4 after 10 years. We traveled a lot. I did a lot of jet-setty things. I met Dr. Schweitzer in Africa, and I went to Venezuela with General Doolittle and one of the astronauts, and I went to the Philippines and everywhere. I went to Europe a lot, and I just had a jet-setty, glamorous, adventurous life. And if it had just been somebody else's. But for me, I knew that wasn't it either. I was grateful to be having the experience, but it was almost like I was on the outside looking at me on the inside, you know. It wasn't it either. I thought school was going to be it. I finally went to law school during that marriage, and I'll tell you something about my drinking. I don't know about you, but as my drinking progressed, for one thing, I had a high tolerance. Later on, I went to work as a prosecuting attorney. I finished law school in there, and I go to work later, which I am now, a prosecuting attorney, and they told me that a high tolerance is a very good symptom and a definite symptom of alcoholism. Well, I didn't know that. I thought it just meant that I was tough and strong and just really a strong will and a strong, good drinker. Because I drank with large men during that fourth marriage. And size makes a difference. I drank glass for glass with large men, and I don't think I behaved any drunker than they did during that period. Now, later my tolerance went down. When I was married, I got to be a lawyer. My husband left me. Some woman came along and took him away from me. Thank goodness. I couldn't figure out how to get out of that. Now I'm a trial lawyer, and I meet this judge. And a few weeks later, he's a patient in the intensive care ward in a private room at UCLA, and we were married in that room. And they told us we were the first wedding that they'd ever had in intensive care. And I wonder, I'll bet we still hold the record. My most memorable throw-up was during that marriage, and I'd like to share that with you. Husband number 5, who shall remain nameless, his idea of controlling it was like this. And, well, this is exactly what happened this evening. We went out and we had the martinis before dinner, the wine with dinner, the scotch and water after dinner, and then we'd had enough scotch and waters after dinner. Husband number 5 says, well, I think we've had enough. We will now switch to liqueurs. I hated that, but I didn't want to make too much of a scene, because I didn't want somebody messing with my drinking. So I went along with it, and we had these green cream de menthe, lots of them, and we had had a red spaghetti dinner. So we got home, and I remember crawling up the stairs to our bedroom. I did many nights then. This was a couple of years before I came into AA for the first time. And I crawled up those stairs and crawled into the bathroom, and I threw up, and that was the most grotesque thing. It's the only specific one I remember, that red and green stuff. But you know what I did? I did what any good alcoholic would do, I believe. I promised I would never eat spaghetti again when I'm drinking. I got out of that marriage, and I was keeping a low profile, staying low, not having coffee with anybody, and my sister brings this guy to the beach where I'm just meeting her and the family, and sure enough, they asked me to drive him home, and he tells me he wants to marry me. Now, I've been married 5 times, and I told him that. I've been married 5 times, I said, and I leave rather quickly from marriages. why don't we just see each other? And we drank alike and we saw each other. But a few weeks later, he said, you gave everyone else a chance. Why not me? Well, I wanted to be fair. By this time, I just liked to drink straight vodka. We were married, and we went to Paris on what would have been a very glamorous trip. But I was a very sick alcoholic, and I really cared about nothing but drinking at that point in my life. Although I was working as a trial lawyer, I just did that. It's something I did was work. But we got back from that trip, and soon thereafter, I said, please excuse me, I've made a giant mistake, and please go away. Just like I told all the rest. And he did. And that was just before I got to AA. Let me tell you, I'd like to tell you how I was living after he left and before I got here. I went to work every day as a trial lawyer. I had accumulated a lot of very nice clothes, ladies' suits and silk dresses and shiny, you know, raw silk and whatever. Very nice clothes that I had accumulated over this period of time, so that I had about 14 outfits, something like that. What I would do, though, I was so depressed. For one thing, I would count on that drink, which I would pick up my supply on the way home, and I would come home and take off my clothes and lay them by the side of my bed. I was too depressed to hang them up. And the next night I would lay it on top, and the next night I'd lay it on top. I had a cleaning lady once a week. I told her just to leave them alone, that I couldn't explain why I had to lay them on the floor. I did not want to talk about it. And then I'd peel them off. After 2 weeks, then I'd start taking them off the top and putting them on and start a pile over here. And if they had to be... the ones that had to be cleaned, I'd roll up in a ball and throw in another section. On the weekend, from Friday till Monday, I did not bathe or shower or shampoo my hair or comb my hair or brush my teeth. I was too depressed, just too depressed. And I had a little trick I played, because I couldn't get by the whole weekend without buying cigarettes or booze. And when I went out to do that, I would tell myself, and I believed it, that if I would look at my feet and not look at you, you wouldn't see me. Because I'd just wear this little jogging outfit, and I'd go out to maybe to Hamburger Hamlet even have a drink with Tommy there if I wanted to watch part of the ball game and drink. And I just pretended I didn't see them. You know, I've never lived like that in my life. I didn't live like that ever. I had also started taking 3 sleeping pills a night after drinking, hoping that that would kill me accidentally. And I had a suicide stash of pills. In a blackout, I made some calls which resulted in my mom and dad coming out. And they asked me to go to AA. And I started going with them. Now, I had always felt that if I ever visited AA for any reason, that I would like it. Because my dad had been in and out. He never quite really got sober. But he gave me the impression that AA was a wonderful place. And I guess I judged you by what I thought Dad was, and I love him very much and still do. I expected you'd be special. I thought that alcoholics would be more sensitive than other people. I thought alcoholics would be more aware than other people, that they would have endured more pain than other people, and that you would be special, and I certainly would like you. So when I started being taken to meetings, I wasn't surprised to find that I did like you and you did seem special. And I liked the speakers. I thought you must have a secret speakers school, because the speakers here were a lot better for me than any I'd ever heard in school or in trial court or anywhere else. And I didn't, of course, think that was identification. And as I was going to say in the beginning, I didn't agree to do any of the stuff. I just wanted to get them off my back so I could commit suicide the following June 2nd, my birthday, and it was in January when I came in here. I cut my pills down to 1 sleeping pill a night. Now, I never was, I don't believe, really addicted to pills. I took them, like it says in the book, to quiet my nerves in between drinks. I did it to enable me to keep working and to support my drinking. Drinking is where I got the effect I needed. Drinking is what I did every day. Drinking was what my life was all about when I got here, and the effect that it had for me. But I cut down to 1 sleeping pill a night, and I knew that that wasn't sobriety, but my attitude was that I would probably commit suicide first anyway, so it didn't matter. And I wasn't necessarily planning to get sober, but after a while I decided to try not to drink. But I didn't take a sponsor, I didn't have any certain meetings or any of that stuff. But I kept showing up. At least I kept showing up because there was that attraction here, and I felt a little bit safe at meetings in spite of everything. And then finally, I heard this person, after a few months of this, I heard this person, Clancy, talk at a Brentwood early meeting. And the thing about that was, this guy sounded as crazy and mixed up as I felt. He really did. But he'd been sober almost 20 years, and he hadn't had anything, any pills, any booze, any anything, but AA. And he looked okay. He looked like he felt okay about being alive and about being sober. So I decided that I would ask maybe if I could talk to that person. He might know some, I decided he knew something I didn't know. And that if he didn't tell me that my case was hopeless and I was wasting my time, if he instead told me to do certain things, that I would do everything here to the best of my ability until I could prove this didn't work either, and then I would commit suicide. Dan mentioned the same plan earlier. I didn't tell him about the suicide plan, I didn't tell him about the pill I had, and I didn't tell him about my suicide stash, which I had 100 secondals and 50 number 4 codeines. But I did everything else. I started doing all the other things. And I started feeling little bits. I started listening. I started feeling a little bit of trust. I didn't know I didn't trust until I started feeling a little trust. I trusted first my sponsor, and then I started trusting other people who are present in this room tonight, and some were not. I started feeling little changes. 4.5 months later, my son was found with pills in his room in the school I had him in, this private school, and they were kicking him out. And then I realized that I had to confess the pills. After I had come here and started saying that I was sober, I figured I would admit the pills before my fifth step or my first birthday, whichever came first, and still I thought I might commit suicide first. But the truth is, I was not sober and I was not honest. And although I didn't have a drink after I got here to this meeting, but I wasn't really sober. So I admitted the pills, and I threw them away. That son of mine is an addict alcoholic, and he stood there and watched me throw them away. I think it hurt him a lot more than it did me. And that's my real sobriety day. But I had started to do the actions, and even and that had started to let me know that this was going to work. Something was working. But I hadn't approached the higher power thing, and I didn't think I ever could. So about 30 days after my real sobriety day, this lady asked me, she said, "You seem awfully uncomfortable as long as you've been coming around here and doing these things," which was a few months. "Do you pray?" And I said, "No, I don't. But I can't do that." I said, "That's a closed door. I've been too far down that road and there's no turning back." And she said she knew someone who had felt that way herself, another lady, and that this lady had tried saying the prayer on page 63, on her knees morning and night for 30 days, and that had helped her. Well, I really believed with all my heart that that wouldn't work. I have read a lot of books, and I've read a lot of books over and over, and it never made me feel better or different, although I just couldn't believe it. But I respected AA, and I respected my fellow alcoholics, and I said, "Sure, I will try it." So I got on my knees, and I read the prayer morning and night, and I felt nothing for a few days, like reading my dictionary to my refrigerator, like, you know, nothing. Silly. But after a few days, I felt something. I felt real uncomfortable with the last line. And how that goes is the prayer, and most of you know it, but for those of you who are new, let me just tell you what happened to me. It says, "Dear God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Believe me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, thy love, thy power, and thy way of life." Now, I was able to want to mean that. No, I could try to mean that, want to mean that. But the last line was choking me up where it says, may I do thy will always. Oh, wait a minute. That sounds like a contract. I'm a lawyer already, right? And that sounds like a contract. What if God wants me to move to Australia and adopt 4 kids? I couldn't think of anything worse than that, and I still can't. So I realized in my pea brain that I didn't trust. I'm feeling a connection, but I don't trust. So I added a sentence at the end, please help me trust in thee, and I don't know when I've dropped it off, but now I have my conscious contact, and I was able to do the third step. But I was able to kind of fake a third step by doing it just with the sponsor and the meetings and, just the actions. And, you know, I have referred to how I made my start here before as a surrender. I don't think it was a surrender. If you knew, I think what it was is that I reached this agreement with myself to pretend I was an alcoholic. But by pretending I was an alcoholic, I made a deal. If I'm going to pretend I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to do everything you do, and then I'm going to prove that I'm not because this won't work. I think that's the same way I did it on the third step. Or at least I pretended to try to believe this, and I made myself try to believe it. But the whole thing is, I never would have thought that actions alone without having faith first. I thought you had to have faith first before you could have faith. You know? But I didn't. I didn't have to have faith that AA was going to work. I didn't have to have faith that a sponsor was going to work. I didn't have to have faith that I was even an alcoholic. And I did not have to have faith in God. I didn't have to have faith in any of that, but actions. Actions brought my feelings forward to make me feel that I was first before I could intellectually. Intellectual means nothing, zero zilch toward quality of life for me. I'm not disparaging the brain. It's a nice thing to have. But it isn't what it told me it was when I got here. I kid you not. I did, as I told you, do a fourth and fifth step. That came along about when I was 8 months sober. And that was a good tangible step to do. But I was told how to do it. As I said, intellectual didn't mean anything. I was given how to do it. I watched you. I watched my examples before and after, and that's what I do now. But I'd like to say this. Here's the payoff. As the lady on the phone at Central Office asked me, why do you still go to this meeting, and what does AA do for you? You know what AA does for me? It makes me feel better than that alcohol ever did. It makes me feel better. It didn't always. Let me tell you this. The first year was hard. But, you know, if we had a deal here where all you had to do is do it 30 days or come in and say, Eureka, I've found it, we wouldn't have any room. There wouldn't be anybody anywhere else. Everybody in the world would be in an AA meeting all the time. So it takes time, you know, just like it took time for me to get sick and get as alcoholic and messed up and despaired as I was in order to get here. And if you're here tonight, I hope you're desperate because that helps. That helps make me more reasonable, and that's in the book, too. I don't know anything that's not in the book. That book is just brilliant. Anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous has made my life better, though, year after year. And it's a solution. What it is on the good days it's a solution, on the bad days it's a solution, and I know it works. My sponsor says intense alcoholics need intense programs. I'm an intense alcoholic, and I've kept an intense program. But I feel calm, I feel peace of mind, and I have a lot of time to feel happy, joyous, and free. This is the best life I've ever had, and it gets better every year. It gets better every year. Right now I have 9 years, 11 months, and 4 days of sobriety. This has certainly been the best year of my life as an inside job. If you knew, you know, this is better than the lottery is all I can tell you. If you're not sure about any of this and you really don't think it'll work, but you think there is some outside chance it might, I hope you decide to pretend that it will long enough to find that this doesn't work either, like I did. Thank you.